A Ukraine expert in the White House was so worried about President Trump's call to Ukraine's president, he told a lawyer.
The expert is an American veteran, so why do some of the president's supporters question his patriotism?
I'm Rachel Martin along with Steve Inskeep, and this is Up First from NPR News. The president contends the U.S. killed another leading figure of ISIS. That came after the death of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the man who once declared himself caliph.
Baghdadi was mainly a symbolic figurehead for ISIS.
How much does it matter who's in charge of what remains of ISIS?
Also, college athletes finally have a chance to share in the profits. The NCAA voted unanimously to allow student athletes to be paid for the use of their names and images. Why change that policy now? Stay with us. We'll guide you through this day's news.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Guardian Insurance, helping nearly 27 million people look after what they love most, because everyone deserves a Guardian. Visit GuardianLife.com. Guardian is a registered trademark of the Guardian Life Insurance Company of America, New York, New York.
Support also comes from the Capital One Walmart Rewards Card. Earn 5% back at Walmart online and 2% at Walmart in-store, restaurants, and travel. The Capital One Walmart Rewards Card. What's in your wallet? Terms and exclusions apply.
Why did President Trump really withhold military aid from Ukraine?
Written testimony from a Foreign Service officer deepens that question in the House impeachment inquiry. Catherine Croft served in a key position concerning Ukraine. Yet in testimony obtained by NPR, she tells impeachment investigators she knew of no reason to withhold the aid. She was only told President Trump had ordered it. Investigators are asking if the president held up the assistance to pressure Ukraine to investigate a political rival. Today's testimony follows Tuesday's interview with Ukraine specialist Alexander Vindman. House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff talked about him this way.
We have the greatest respect for his service to the country, a service that continues. And today took the form of coming before our committees to bravely answer these questions. We hope that his example of patriotism will be emulated by others.
Vindman listened to the president's phone call with Ukraine's leader back in July when Trump asked for investigations. He says he was so concerned that he consulted a lawyer. The New York Times and the Wall Street Journal report that Vindman says the White House record of the call leaves out some relevant phrases. The New York Times reported that the missing phrases did not change the meaning of the call, though. NPR has not independently confirmed that, but the White House record does include ellipses, dot, 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 which indicate missing words.
NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales is covering the story. She's in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
What could be missing here?
Well, as you said, the New York Times is reporting that Vindman told House investigators that the partial transcript released by the White House is missing these key phrases. He said that this included a Trump assertion of recordings of Vice President Joe Biden.
Claiming also, that there was some kind of recording of Biden talking about corruption in Ukraine
exactly,
or something like
that? Exactly, okay. Yeah, signaling that this exists, as well as a mention of Burisma Holdings, which is the energy company where Joe Biden's son Hunter worked. And this undercuts what the president has said in the past, that the White House had a, quote, word-for-word, comma-for-comma transcript that would silence his critics. And, of course, the White House has said that the transcript they released was not verbatim.
I guess we should be clear, this alleged reference to recordings, we have no idea what those are, right?
Exactly.
We don't know if there's any secret recording or anything like that.
Right.
How did lawmakers respond to this?
Well, Democrats called it a powerful testimony from a current White House official. Vindman is a decorated Iraqi war veteran and a top Ukraine expert at the National Security Council, and he was alarmed at Trump's demands for a Ukrainian investigation of the Bidens, and he repeatedly reported these concerns to his superiors, but Republicans had a much different take. For example, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said Vindman was, quote, wrong in his recollection. This, as other Republicans argued, less with the substance of the testimony and more with the process. Take a listen to New York Republican Lee Zeldin.
This process has been illegitimate. It's been without credibility. It's been without fairness. This was an opportunity clearly wasted by the speaker.
And so there were some Republicans that went after Vindman personally, questioned his loyalty or talked about his service, but many Republicans pushed back on that and said that was an area that should not be handled
in such
a way.
So even some Republicans said it was a smear to talk about this person's patriotism just because he said something that was inconvenient for them politically.
Yeah.
Now, there's going to be more testimony today, as we mentioned. What's expected?
So two State Department officials are expected to testify today, Catherine Croft and Christopher Anderson. We know some of what they'll say from opening statements we obtained for NPR, and both worked on Ukraine. Croft is a former NSC director, and Anderson is a former special advisor. They worked alongside a previous witness, Kirk Volker, who has already testified. Anderson, in particular, would tell lawmakers that State Department officials were stopped by the White House from issuing a statement condemning Russia. Huh. There will be one area they will not touch on, which is exposing any details that will help lawmakers understand who the whistleblower is that triggered this entire probe.
Oh, that's right. We should note that as the testimony continues, the House is preparing to vote tomorrow to formally approve this impeachment inquiry and set some rules for the examination. What are those rules?
Yes, so this signals this impeachment inquiry is on the verge of moving into a public phase, complete with public hearings and witnesses. The resolution includes a framework for the rules of questioning witnesses. It also allows minority members to request subpoenas with the approval of the chairman. It also directs the Intelligence Committee to issue a public report on its recommendations. This could all be taken up by the Judiciary Committee, which would be the panel that approves the potential articles of impeachment before they go to the House floor.
To what extent does this answer concerns of Republicans who have said, listen, this process has been private up to now. We haven't had any power in this process up to now. And now the House Democrats are saying you're going to get some.
Yeah, so this does undercut a Republican talking point. And now you can see Republicans already shifting to a new talking point, which is these rules really aren't going to impact a process that is already tainted. And they still consider the inquiry to be a sham. So it doesn't quite take away their new talking point where they are now.
Claudia, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
That's NPR's Claudia Grisales. Is the Islamic State now operating without a leader?
The U.S. says a commando raid led to the death of ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And yesterday, the president said on Twitter that Baghdadi's, quote, number one replacement has been terminated. The president did not give a name.
Well, who does replace Baghdadi and how much does it matter? NPR national security correspondent Hannah Alam is here. Good morning.
Good morning.
What is ISIS saying about its leadership?
Well, it's saying nothing at the moment. The group itself hasn't even acknowledged the death of Baghdadi, much less said anything official about a potential successor. That's not unusual. Al-Qaeda took a few days before confirming Osama bin Laden's death. But it is something to keep in mind, because until ISIS officially announces, everything is speculation. That being said, of course, a group like ISIS doesn't operate without a succession plan. Any senior leader of a group of this profile instantly becomes one of the most high-value targets in the world. It's not a job you typically retire from. You end up killed or captured. So, of course, there's a list of potential heirs, but at this point, it's a bunch of names until an official successor is designated.
No, I suppose if you're ISIS, you're a little reluctant to make that announcement, perhaps, because that person would become a high-value target instantly.
Indeed. And also, we don't have a clear picture yet who's dead, who's been captured, who's still even out there able to take over the group.
Any idea who President Trump was talking about when he said the second choice, or the number one choice as a successor, I suppose I should say, was killed?
Yeah, we asked about this. One U.S. official told us Trump was referring to Abu Hassan al-Muhajir, a senior ISIS spokesman, a close aide to Baghdadi. But there was some confusion because we'd already known he was dead for about 24 hours before Trump tweeted it. Al-Muhajir was said to be killed in a separate raid soon after Baghdadi's death. And certainly Muhajir was a contender, but as we've said, there have been other names floated. And for Trump to kind of boast that the U.S. had taken out the number one replacement for Baghdadi, it might overstate the case.
That other question then, how much does it matter who the leader of ISIS is?
It is important. It sets the tone for the direction of ISIS going forward. Baghdadi oversaw the group in its bloody heyday. His most important legacy is the declaration of a caliphate. He ruled, this extremist mini-state. And the caliphate idea was the big draw for the extremists who came en masse to join ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And the group was clever enough to put the focus on that mission and that goal of the caliphate rather than to make ISIS a cult of personality around Baghdadi. I spoke to Amarnath Amarasingam. He's a Canadian terrorism researcher, and he's interviewed several ISIS members, and he asked them the succession question. Here's the answer he got.
Often the answer was, you know, we're not really fighting for a person, right? We're not really fighting for an individual. We're fighting for a state. We're fighting for this caliphate project, and we're fighting for this kind of historical moment, or this kind of historical state-building moment.
So, yes, ISIS is weakened. It's lost its so-called caliphate and its leader within the space of a few months. It's at a crossroads, and the next leader does face a big task about rebuilding those forces, making sure the group doesn't splinter. But the one thing analysts do agree on is don't call ISIS vanquished.
Hannah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's NPR's Hannah Alam. Colleges and coaches make millions of dollars from the play of student-athletes. The athletes have not.
At least not until now. The NCAA Board of Governors unanimously voted yesterday that college athletes can profit from marketing their own names and images. The college sports governing body was under pressure after California passed a law allowing student-athletes to make money.
Kavitha Davidson is a reporter for The Athletic and co-hosts the podcast The Lead and is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
How much pressure was the NCAA under?
Well, the NCAA was on a lot of pressure. As you mentioned, California had just passed a bill earlier this month granting what's known as nil rights to college athletes. That's the right to profit off of their names, images, and likenesses. And we actually had California Governor Gavin Newsom on our podcast to talk about this. And he said that one of his stated goals was to put pressure on the NCAA to handle this as a whole themselves. Now, other states like Ohio and Florida had been exploring similar bills. Senator Cory Booker, who we have on the podcast today, actually it proposed a plan as part of his presidential platform that would bring this issue under federal law. And in May, as a response to, you know, these various legislative proposals that have been popping up, the NCAA ordered its Board of Governors to form a commission to study this. And the recommendation from this group led to yesterday's announcement from the NCAA.
I guess we can imagine the classic political situation that people sometimes face. They have a step they maybe don't want to take. They're on their way to being forced to take it. And so they decide to take it so that they can at least set the rules and control the conditions. And in this case, they make this statement that it's allowing athletes to profit from their names and images. I guess that doesn't mean they can get paid athlete salaries, right?
Well, they don't get paid athlete salaries. They're very clear that this does not mean college athletes become employees. It's not pay for play. None of the payments would come from the university. They would come from outside businesses. But we also have to be really careful here, because what the NCAA announced yesterday was not an actual new policy. It was that they are ordering this commission that they formed to further study this. And then by the deadline of April of next year, the three divisions, Division 1, 2, and 3, then have to formulate new policies themselves by January of 2021. All of this comes with a major caveat. Like you said, you know, in politics, if you want to formulate a new rule like this, it's better to do it yourself so you can kind of impose your own conditions. The conditions here, you know, the NCAA stressed that these policies has to be, quote, consistent with the collegiate model, and that they must align with NCAA principles, which, you know, depending on how the NCAA interprets that, could really radically limit the scope of any new policies they actually institute.
Well, granting the pressure the NCAA was under, is there anybody expressing sadness in a way that they regret the passing of the idea of the amateur athlete, the ideal of that?
I mean, people always kind of bring that up. You always talk to college coaches, you know, who kind of benefit from this system, especially with, you know, the salaries that they're being paid in the big business of college basketball and college football. And they kind of lament that you would lose the purity of the game. But, you know, if you're asking my opinion on that, I think that, you know, competitive balance has already kind of been under attack. There really isn't so much purity in what is a multi-billion dollar industry. So I think that what people are kind of arguing right now against that is that college athletes should be able to make money in an outside job, whether that's signing autographs or having someone pay them for their jerseys, the way that other students on campus are able to.
Kavitha Davidson of The Athletic and co-host of the podcast The Lead. Thanks for this.
Thank you.
And that's Up First for this Wednesday, October 30th. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Up First will be back tomorrow, but you can hear more from NPR right at this very moment. Check out our new daily science podcast, Shortwave. Today's episode, crows. They get a bad rap, especially around Halloween. I mean, a group of them is called a murder of crows, for crying out loud. But the really amazing thing is how smart they are. That's this week. It's part of a special batch of spooky episodes on Shortwave, NPR's daily science podcast.
Shouldn't you say Shortwave?
No.
Okay.
Halloween is supposed to be a scary time of the year, but you've seen the news.
Real life is so scary. Racism is so scary. Climate change is so scary.
Fear in an Age of Real Life Horror on NPR's Code Switch.